from our rooftop studio inside the elevator machinery chamber at the Ritz Hotel. We present the Indie Week. John Federson here, along with this week's musical staff, Yolanda and Harold Buff Orpington, for this week's issue, dated March 11th, 2020, and read for our blind and print-impaired listeners over the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. As soon as Harold presses his button down, the duo, there they go, that will depart until the closing of today's program. Last week, our column from Voices was by Jonathan Weiler. It was part one of the plot to control America, and here it comes with part two to open this week's broadcast. In June 2013, in a case called Shelby County versus Holder, the United States Supreme Court overturned a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. Section 5 of the landmark law, passed in 1965, required that states with a history of voting discrimination get pre-clearance from the Justice Department before making changes to their election laws. Congress had reauthorized the VRA regularly since its original passage, most recently in 2006, when a bipartisan majority re-upped it for 25 years and President George W. Bush signed it into law. But in writing for the court in a 5-4 decision, Chief Justice John Roberts argued for the conservative bloc that preclearance was outdated because both the problems that animated the VRA had been greatly ameliorated and because changes since 1965 would require a new preclearance coverage formula, which Congress was welcome to try its hand at. It hasn't. In her dissent, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg observed that throwing out preclearance when it has worked and continues to work is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. As sure as day follows night, a deluge of new laws began appearing within days of the removal of that umbrella. Texas, North Carolina, Wisconsin, and elsewhere, legislatures approved new impediments to voter registration, making it easier to purge voter rolls and, of course, imposing new photo ID requirements. North Carolina passed one of the furthest reaching of these laws. Its provisions included more limited early voting, elimination of same-day registration, and new voter photo ID requirements that excluded those for students at state universities. College students, for obvious reasons, are a common target of such legislation, government workers, and those on public assistance. In 2016, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals invalidated the law, ruling that it tried, quote, to target African Americans with almost surgical precision. The court noted that the law's backers had, quote, failed to identify even a single individual who has ever been charged with committing in-person voter fraud in North Carolina. These bills aren't the only means by which Republican office holders are trying to winnow and cull the electorate. In 2018, by a two-thirds majority, Floridians approved a ballot measure to restore voting rights to state residents who had completed felony sentences. Florida was one of the handful of states that permanently barred convicted felons from voting even after they did their time. It's also the largest such state by far, meaning it has the most such disenfranchised individuals, over 1 million people, a disproportionate share of whom are black. In an attempt to overturn the referendum results, the Republican-controlled legislature passed a law that would deny people the right to vote until they paid all, quote, restitution, including court fees accrued during their imprisonment. As of now, the law has been invalidated. A federal judge ruled earlier this year that it amounted to a poll tax since it made voting rights dependent on one's ability to pay. Florida is, of course, appealing. All of this is arguably a prelude to an even more insidious development. Since the 2016 election, President Trump has insisted, without evidence, naturally, that the only reason he didn't win the popular vote, he lost by nearly 3 million, was that millions of non-citizens voted illegally. He has also repeatedly denounced the birthright citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment, which stipulates that any person born in the United States, essentially regardless of their parents' status, is a citizen. Two failed Trump efforts are noteworthy in this context. One was his attempt to put a citizenship question on the 2020 census, which, because its insidious political motivations were so obvious that even a clearly sympathetic Roberts Court couldn't ignore them, ended in a legal defeat. The other was the Election Integrity Commission he convened and filled with voting fraud conspiracy theorists, which collapsed under the weight of its own bad faith and incompetence last year. These efforts, whatever their immediate effects on election outcomes, sow mistrust about the integrity of American elections. Whether or not they fail, what motivates them is clear: to cast doubt on the validity of claims to citizenship, including the right to vote, by certain kinds of people. This is a standing threat to our democracy. And over to the good, the bad, and the awful for this week. Good: women of color in the Triangle. Come December, the Durham County Board of Commissioners will comprise 5 women, 3 of whom are women of color, including the first Muslim woman elected in North Carolina, Nida Alam. Alexandra Valladares will become the first Latinx person on Durham County's Board of Education. Natalie Murdoch won the Democratic primary for the District 20 state Senate seat. Wake County elected a Latina, Maria Serrania, to its Board of Commissioners. Wake County Commissioner Jessica Holmes, whom Servania will replace, should make a strong bid for Labor Commissioner this fall. And Yvonne Holley led a crowded field last week in the primary for Lieutenant Governor, though she may face a runoff in May. The bad: young non-voters. If you were surprised at Joe Biden's 19-point romp in North Carolina last week, look no further than who showed up and who didn't. Between the 2016 election and September 2019, 1.1 million people registered to vote in North Carolina. 61% of them were under 30. According to exit polls, Bernie Sanders trounced the field among 17 to 29-year-olds, pulling 57% to Biden's 19%. Even among everyone under 45, Bernie beat Biden 42 to 29. However, the under-30s comprised just 14% of the voters, while under-45s made up only 36%. The other 64%, those 45 and up, went for Biden, 49 to 14. And that's how youth-fueled political movements die. And for awful, guess who? We got the coronavirus. Since the first confirmation that COVID-19 has reached North Carolina last week, we've vacillated between fits of panic and wondering if everyone is raiding Costco's toilet paper supply for no good reason. Here's what we know. The coronavirus can be serious, especially for the elderly and those with compromised immune systems. Because the U.S. is so far behind in testing, there are likely thousands of additional cases we've yet to confirm. The further it spreads, the more it will disrupt daily life. The Italian government just placed the entire country, 60 million people, on lockdown. The more that happens, the more likely it is to lead to a recession. Here's what we hope. Some viruses peter out in warmer weather, so it's possible that spring and summer will slow COVID-19's advance. Fingers crossed. And now we go to our regional columnist, Lee Taus from Raleigh. Paint the town red. Raleigh plans to spend an extra $720,000 to fancify its bus shelters. Is that a waste? You won't be able to miss Raleigh's new bus shelters. That's the point. Over the next 4 years, the city plans to spend $5.8 million installing the bright red modern-looking shelters at 200 bus stops across the city. The goal isn't just to keep riders dry while they wait, but to draw more people to Go Raleigh. But the city has more pressing needs, says Councilmember David Cox, and it could have saved $720,000 by going with a standard black option. We need to provide great service and not branding, Cox told the Indy via text message. There are better uses for the money. There are many. He was the lone dissenter last week when the council voted on the project's first phase, which will construct 30 shelters. Now, this project has been in the pipeline since 2016, but got delayed in 2018 when the previous council requested more time to review design options. The council reviewed the final designs and the cheaper option last week. The latter would cost about $4,700 per shelter. The model the council selected comes in at about $8,300 a pop. That's a difference of about $3,600 per. I'm not saying it's a small amount. The figures you're seeing are not small numbers, I agree, Assistant Transportation Director David Eatman told the council. But in the grand scheme of the total cost of nearly $30,000 on average, it's not as large as you would think about in that context. Well, that's because three-quarters of the cost of installing shelters is the groundwork necessary to install them and make them ADA compliant, about $20,000. So in total, the more expensive option comes out to $28,003 per shelter, while the standard design $24.7. The city conducted an online survey in December to vet the new design. 47% of the 758 respondents liked the new look. 41% said they didn't. Go Raleigh's new branding was created to foster a more cohesive, user-friendly image and thus lure more new riders. But the transit system also wanted to provide a better experience for current riders, said Nathan Spencer, Go Raleigh Board's vice chairman. They deserve nice things, too. We're talking about spending a little extra on shelters, and people are very upset, and the truth is we've been doing this for cars for a long time, Spencer says. We need to be focused on the investments we're making for riders because they push this economy every day. Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin believes the updated design is worth the price tag. This has been in the works for 4 years, she says. A lot of thought and intentionality has gone into this. I think not moving forward sends the wrong message to the community about the value of design. Although Councilmember Sage Martin criticized the shelter's defensive design elements, including bars on the bench to prevent people from lying down, he supports the overall project. Not only does this put us on the map, you're not going to miss this bus stop, Martin said during the council meeting. Waiting for a bus without a place to sit or shelter from a storm can be a dehumanizing experience. Councilmember Patrick Bufkin added, he hopes businesses that employ residents who depend on the bus system will become sponsors to help offset this cost. Still, Cox takes issue with the council's priorities. So far, we've created a fund for the homeless with $25,000, says Cox, who is said to be mulling a run for mayor next year. I think the contrast in what we are spending on branding speaks volumes. Diverting transportation funds to other purposes isn't that simple. And the Compassion Fund, to which Cox is referring, created in February, uses the council's contingency money. But perhaps he has a point about who these shiny new shelters are meant for. The defensive design elements, after all, are there to keep the homeless from using the benches as beds. And over to Durham and Tomasi McDonald's. The bus doesn't stop here anymore. Go Durham wants some former riders to take a lift. This might work out better for everyone. Rashad Williams can cook his butt off. The 33-year-old head chef at Braley's Sports Bar and Grill on Hillsborough Road didn't attend culinary school. He learned it at his grandmother's knee. In addition to the burger and fries on the menu, he prepares on-demand dishes like a shepherd's pie with rich brown gravy drizzling down its modulated sides and a chicken pot pie with a puffed pastry, one of his favorites. He's been working at Braley's for a little over a year, making $14 an hour. He doesn't own a car because he has epilepsy, so each morning he took Go Durham's 11B bus, which stopped in front of his apartment on Chapel Hill Street near the Ghost Bike Memorial at 9:30 a.m. The bus dropped him off at an intersection a few yards from work just before his 10 a.m. shift. It cost him a dollar. But one morning in late January, the 11B didn't show up. It didn't show up the next day either. On January 25th, with little or no notice, Go Durham discontinued the route. Williams had to start using Uber. That first trip cost $10, he says, but the prices have gone up. Earlier this week, he says he paid $16. A one-way trip, $26, he says. Let me get some groceries with that. Sean Egan, Durham's new director of transportation, says the city rerouted about 20 lines because of low ridership. The Hillsborough Road line, for instance, made 12 trips each weekday, but only averaged 2 boardings each trip, Egan says. To accommodate riders inconvenienced by the changes, the city began piloting a new program on February 5, East Durham Connect. If it works, the city says, it could make transportation both easier for residents and cheaper for the city. Instead of waiting for hourly bus boardings, riders in a few East Durham neighborhoods with disrupted service can use their phone to immediately summon a Lyft 6 days a week. With an access code, the Lyft will take them to work and other destinations, including bus stops and shopping centers, along the discontinued route for free. City spokeswoman Beverly Thompson says the pilot program is expected to run through June and perhaps into next year. Egan says Go Durham is considering deploying the program in other areas, including the old 11B route, which now stops at a subdivision entrance off of Neal Road, more than a mile from Braille's restaurant. None of that helps Rashad Williams right now. To catch the bus these days, he has to wake up an hour early, walk a mile to a bus stop near downtown. He huffs a little over a mile again when the bus that used to stop yards from his gig drops him off at Neal Road. Sometimes Braille's owner, Leslie Crabtree, gives Williams and his co-worker a ride to the bus stop. I don't want them to have to walk, Crabtree says. The pilot program is part of an emerging policy Mayor Steve Shule laid out in his State of the City address last week. In that speech, Shule connected the legacy of racism to the climate crisis, poverty, housing, crime, racial equity, and public transit in Durham. Already, Shule says, climate change has hit Durham's black residents the hardest in several ways. Historically redlined black neighborhoods are still bereft of tree cover, and African Americans are more likely than white to be poor, unhealthy, and lack access to medical care, which means they're also more susceptible to the effects of extreme heat. The death of light rail last year, Shule continued, was a severe blow to the region's effort to create an environmentally sustainable transit system, but he acknowledged that rail would have primarily served whiter, wealthier residents. Most of the city's nearly 21,000 bus boardings each weekday, on the other hand, come from people of color. We must prioritize our bus system and the people who ride it, Shule says. Even under the most optimistic scenarios, we will not see regional transportation on the ground for at least 10 years. After Duke University pulled the plug on light rail, one question has lingered. What's going to happen to the $30 million in annual sales tax revenue the county collected for the ill-fated project? About $3 million has been set aside to develop plans for a commuter rail between Raleigh and Durham. City transportation officials have asked the Board of Commissioners that another $26 million be dedicated to improving Go Durham. Egan says that prior to creating a bus service improvement plan, the city conducted onboard surveys with riders traveling to and from their destinations. Officials followed up by hosting about 80 events across the city, with a particular eye towards engaging hard-to-reach Latinx and residents where they listened to concerns about bus service. The big takeaway, Egan says, people want improvements now. There will be more requests from the transportation department than there is money in the Capital Transit Fund, he adds. The city's request includes $10 million from the fund for improvements along Fayetteville Street, such as increasing frequency so the buses arrive every 15 minutes, adding more shelters and benches, and creating boarding areas large enough for strollers and wheelchairs. Another $6 million would go to purchase electric buses, and $1.1 would be allocated to add service during off-peak times. The city has 1,000 bus stops, Egan says, and the city wants to improve all of them, 50 at a time. None of that helps Teddy Hall right now either. Hall, a 51-year-old cook at Brails, is on his feet all day. To catch the 11B at Neal Road, he has to walk more than a mile down Bennett Memorial, a rural stretch that doesn't have sidewalks. He walks on the shoulder or out on the street, which is pretty darn dangerous, Hall says, especially when I leave here at 10 o'clock at night. He says the Lyft vouchers sound cool, but he doesn't think they're the best solution. I think it would be more convenient if the bus stops here, he said. That would be more convenient for me. Right now I'm being inconvenienced and have to come out of pocket, but my taxes are being used to pay for service and salaries. But we're the ones being inconvenienced. Before Route 11B was discontinued, a Go Durham bus stopped near the Vocational Rehab Center on Western Park Place, where residents with physical, mental, learning disabilities, or emotional impairments are given training that helps them obtain or maintain employment. Now, this center's clients, many of whom have mobility limitations or use adaptive equipment, have an additional challenge. They can't make it to a bus stop that's over a mile away, says Kelly Haight, a spokeswoman with the State Department of Health and Human Services, which runs the center. Consequently, they've missed appointments and orientation sessions, quote, and now must rely on email and phone calls, which can be frustrating and more difficult for the population we serve, Haight told the Indy in an email. Haight says the vocational services staff has made adjustments, but the route changes resulted in an increase in missed appointments, with staffers spending more time traveling, which limits the number of persons that can be served in a day. The center has been in the same location for 40 years, Haight said. The population here already has a number of obstacles to overcome in trying to obtain and achieve employment, she says, and restricted access to services makes it more difficult for them to achieve their goals. Now, this next article by Keisha Jennings refers to a concert tomorrow night at Lincoln Theater in Raleigh, and I can't guarantee whether this is actually going to occur. It's a small venue, so they may still continue. A lot of, due to the coronavirus, a lot of get-togethers have been postponed or canceled. However, this is called Rhapsody's Wisdom, and it's about Rhapsody. Everywhere I look, I'm surrounded by amazing black women, Rhapsody says. She's calling from the road in the middle of A Black Woman Created This Tour, which began in Philadelphia in February and ends with a homecoming show at Lincoln Theater in Raleigh tomorrow night. Friday, March 13th, that is. The tour is a victory lap for Eve, Rhapsody's critically acclaimed third album, which was released in August of 2019. The Snow Hill, North Carolina native began her music career in Raleigh with Coolie High and Ninth Wonder, before going on to earn Jay-Z co-signs, Grammy nominations, and Kendrick Lamar collaborations as a solo artist. Like Eve, which paid homage to black women with titles like Nina, as in Simone, Oprah, as in Winfrey, and Alia, as in Alia, the title of the tour evokes a sense of pride and sass that is specific to black women. Right now, Rhapsody's tribe of hashtag professional black girls includes booking agent Yves Pierre, tour manager Felicia Bennett, photographer and videography by Latroya Brooks, Jamla Records vice president Tia Watlington, and Rhapsody's stylist, the legendary hip-hop architect Misa Hilton. Not only do I speak about it in the music, but I walk it in my real life, Rhapsody says. I make sure that we support our sisters, so throughout the tour, we've been highlighting black businesses owned by black women. It's been amazing all the way around. From her nail art and gold accessories to her classic kicks and her popping cornrows, sometimes with beads added, Rhapsody's collaboration with Hilton amplifies her black woman aesthetic while matching her sonic and lyrical vibe. The two first met in 2016 when Hilton was assigned to style Rhapsody for an event hosted by Puma. Rhapsody admired the way Hilton advocated for her to always be herself. In an industry filled with unrealistic expectations for women, a host of gimmicks, and an excessive amount of plastic surgery, Hilton's support was crucial. When it was time for Rhapsody to hire a permanent stylist, Hilton was the first person she thought of. "She's been like another big sister," Rhapsody says. "She not only styles me and helps me grow in that aspect, but she's also taught me so much about myself as a person." For Rhapsody, getting to connect with her fans on a more intimate level throughout the tour has also been amazing. Through meet and greets, she interacts with dozens of fans at each show. As an artist, she finds it inspiring and fulfilling to see firsthand the impact of her talents. Her authentic, down-to-earth homegirl vibe is a breath of fresh air. "Everybody has a story to tell, and I'm so thankful," Rhapsody says. "I've heard stories from women like, 'You've inspired me to go for this promotion that I've been wanting to go for, and I'm the only black woman at my job,' or, 'Yo, in my business, being a black woman is challenging for me every day, and your music keeps me from snapping.'" The music industry in general, and hip-hop in particular, have a history of making the journey more challenging for the black women. Since the days of Roxanne Shanté and Sparky D, women have been paid less, blatantly ignored, placed in narrow lanes, and pitted against one another. With a solid decade of experience under her belt, Rhapsody acknowledges that the industry is more intense for black women. With this tour, she's intentionally creating opportunities for other women to win. "I'm making sure I have black women around me," she says. "When it's all said and done, I want to be able to say I've made it easier for the women coming after me. I want to know that however they want to show up, they can show up. They don't have to be a carbon copy of anybody to be successful." In the beginning of her career, like most aspiring artists, Rhapsody associated success with a label deal, national radio spins, platinum plaques, and award shows. But with experience comes wisdom. "I now understand," she says, "that this success is waking up and being able to do what you love and still have peace of mind." Success is about inspiring others, whether or not she sells a million records or wins a certain number of awards. And she comments here, her second album, Layla's Wisdom, was nominated for 2 Grammys, but Eve was controversially snubbed. "Regardless of any award, I touched people, impacted people, and inspired people," she says. "I want to be able to look back and say, I brought somebody with me. I opened doors. I supported this person, the same way Queen Latifah and Ra Digga supported me. At the end of the day, that is what we are here for, to gain knowledge and share knowledge and create change." Our music article now from Harris Wheelis, Rocksteady. This is about an excellent album, IV, or 4, Roman numerals. Excuse me if I don't understand which is which. Drag Sounds is the group. As the train lurched onto the track, Trevor Reese settled down, headphones in, thumbs on his phone, to make the best of the short ride from D.C. to Baltimore, where he lived at the time. The best would be to pull into the station with a completed song. Reese, half of the core duo of the rock band Drag Sounds, was heading home from tour, reflecting on all the hours spent hunched over the wheel of a van, eyes glazing as the center line stared back, unblinking. This was several years ago when Reese and his triangle-based bandmate Mike Wallace were working on the songs that would eventually compose Drag Sounds' long gestating album, IV. On tour in Memphis, they had visited the Stax Museum, where they gleefully beheld the mixing board that Alex Chilton used to record 3 big star LPs and his solo debut, Like Flies on Sherbet. Back in the van, Reese gazed absently at a Chills record on the floor, and the pieces of his song started falling into place. As the train barreled through the countryside, he stared at the lines typed on his screen. "Flies on the board, Chills on the floor. What next?" "I was looking at the lyrics. I was listening to music and the train was rocking, Reese said. So it was like, hell yeah, we're all rocking, side by side, we're all rocking. A few more verses and revisions later, the song became Like Flies on the Board. It appears on Ivy, which was released in October 2019 and also features drummer Lee Hinshaw. The music was culled from separate songwriting sessions, voice demos sent between Reese and Wallace, and all the rails and highways ridden between Maryland and North Carolina for weekend practices. Like its persona, the band's songwriting process is loose and off the cuff, yet the songs have a sustained heartbeat to which the duo's chemistry and work ethic give shape. Where stripped down meets unpretentious, great ideas collide and gel into elemental songs. But Drag Sound's days of remote collaboration are over. Reese now lives in Durham, Wallace and Raleigh. Sitting at Reese's kitchen table, the two longtime friends and bandmates swap stories and crack beers as they reminisce about the good, the bad, and the just plain awful times endured over the band's 9 years of existence, which includes several LPs, live releases, long tours, lineup changes, and all kinds of logistical acrobatics. Throughout it all, Drag Sounds has been a fortifying constant in their lives. We had a point where it was like, the worst thing we can do is stop doing this, Reese said. We had toured and kept playing and moving around enough to be like, man, I've spent too many hours on the train and the bus to screw this up. The goal was never to play arenas or even necessarily to make a living as career musicians. It was to play raw, straightforward rock and roll. If they had a little success along the way, so be it. It all started when they first performed as a covers act in their hometown of Greensboro at a New Year's Eve party in 2011. They played a few more shows and cycled through some band names, but nothing stuck. With an upcoming gig, they racked their brains for something to put on the flyer. Mark Wingfield, the band's original bassist, suggested Drag Sounds. It would go on the flyer for that night and all those from then on. Drag Sounds has developed a flexible, ragged garage rock sound that flirts with every corner of the punk and rock canon. Reese and Wallace have played in many bands together, Roughheads, Ghost Beach, Estrangers, Pistol Crash, but Drag Sound has outlasted them all. They've paid their dues in small venues across the state, shrinking from a quartet to a trio to a duo, embracing rough and ready guitar minimalism. Their influences, too, are fading into the background of a mature, confident sound all their own. After touring the same batch of songs for years, Wallace and Reese decided it was time to put something down on tape, but the initial sessions for Ivy didn't do justice to the material and were scrapped. They booked another recording session with Missy Thangs at the Fidelitorium and came away with something that felt right, an aural summation of a half decade on the road. Ivy opens with a lull of studio noise that bursts apart as sharp guitar lines and slurred verses careen into each other in quick succession. From the opener, That Stuff's Illegal, the band flirts from short, taut punk sounds to extended slow burners, their trademark dual guitar sleaze occasionally punctuated by volleys of horns, keys, and drums, supplied by Hinshaw and horn players Crowmeat Bob and David Schwenkter. Masters of understatement, Wallace and Reese spin anthemic yarns full of wit, homage, wordplay, and self-parody on Ivy. With their alternately brash and self-deprecating sense of humor, the band favors cheeky song titles like Let It Me. That's one that Reese had jokingly stuck onto a few scattered guitar parts. A few weeks later, Wallace woke up in a crucial daze with a hangover at a stranger's house with the sun sign so full of muck. He found his glasses under the couch, saw 30 missed calls on his phone, and pulled up his GPS wondering, where the hell am I? Sometimes the lyrics just write themselves. Now we're moving on, says Reese. That's a chapter. Put the bookmark in. We're starting another short story. After so many lineup changes, they've decided to simplify rather than complicate. So they're carrying on as a two-piece, weaving in and out of the stuttery, contained beat of a drum machine. New songs, new riffs, and new arrangements continue to shoot out of the duo's fiery, creative dynamo. This next crap might not have any guitars, Wallace says. It might be like keys and bass. I effing just bought a bass. I'm digging playing this effing bass. Synthesizer, bass, drum machine, record. Guess what? That's also drag sounds. We can do what we want. None of your business. How about that? And continuing with our arts columns, Byron Woods, for our stage, talks about a new production of Marat Saad, which is scheduled, again, for Durham Friends Meeting in Durham at 7:30 p.m. Saturday night and Sunday also. It runs from March 14th to Sunday, March 29th, 7:30 p.m. Tickets $15 to $18 at Durham Friends Meeting. And you have to pay attention to viral-based closings and shutdowns. But however, here we go, a prolific Durham songwriter. A musical theater adventure with the Marquis de Sade. For a musician who's already plumbed humanity through a dizzying array of lenses, from tardigrades and silver bears to Dracula by way of Hegel, perhaps it was inevitable that Al Riggs, who uses a lowercase a in their performance name, would eventually wind up writing music for the Marquis de Sade. Now, thanks to a licensing hiccup that Bear Theatre encountered while Riggs was serendipitously working on an album of Stephen Sondheim covers, that moment has come. The Marquis de Sade, 18th-century writer and mind games grandmaster whose extreme sexual proclivities inspired the word sadism, was immortalized in the notorious play Marat Saad. Bear Theatre, which is producing the play at a Quaker Meeting House in Durham, March 14th to 29th, discovered that Richard Peasley's original score cost far more to license and rent than the playwright Peter Weiss's script. So director Dustin Britt called in Riggs to write new music, which would also clear the way for a considerably different production than the one originally produced by the Royal Shakespeare Company in 1964. If I used that music, said Britt, I was never going to be able to escape from that production. I was going to be stuck. In Weiss's text, Saad, who was imprisoned in a French asylum during the last decade of his life, persuades its administrators to let him direct his fellow inmates in a musical history play about the French Revolution as a supposedly noble experiment in art therapy. Too late. His true agenda of revenge stands revealed when his play inflicts psychological damage specifically tailored to each member of the cast. Though Riggs is a prolific songwriter and a musical theater fan, they'd never written music for others to perform. The theatrical assignment gave them a chance to flex their musical muscles in several new directions. I wanted to prove to myself and to the phantom people who would care and don't exist that I could write something other than guitar-based folk music and rock music, Riggs says. The temptation to take up Weiss's work was reinforced by shortcomings Riggs found in the original score. Looking at it contextually, you've got an asylum filled with people with mental health issues, Riggs says. There's absolutely no way in hell any of them would have been able to pull off these needlessly complex and obtuse previous arrangements. They're almost Zappa-esque. Though they'd seen the film version years before, Riggs made it a point not to consult the original score, not even to check if I was ripping anything off while setting Adrian Mitchell's lyrics to new music. I only had the physical script in front of me. I just wanted to be a very pure thing that totally came from the words first, Riggs says. A lot of times I was guided by the contextual mood of the scene, and I collaborated with Dustin Britt in figuring out the tone. And a lot of times I was told to abandon the tone and mood and kind of create something in a bubble that would then inspire the mood of the actual scene. The influences in Riggs' cycle range from vaudeville and Kurt Weill to East German church music and beyond. A song for the character Jacques Roux, a radical priest, has, quote, dissonant chords performed with the same kind of joy and energy as a tent revival, Riggs says. But they're quick to credit three specific inspirations: the heavy, intricate guitar drones of Sun O, an obscure Scottish songwriter Ivor Cutler, whose sardonic satires Riggs calls proto-magnetic fields, and British songwriter Richard Dawson, whose 2017 album Peasant included a forbidding song called Ogre. Riggs and Britt both thought of it when talking about what the show would sound like. The contrast between horror and celebration screamed Marat Saad to me, Britt says. Still, writing music was complicated by the fact that the band didn't exist yet. The actors, who were still being cast, would play the instruments and sing the songs. As they worked through the score, Riggs feared an ensemble that could only play ukuleles and guitars. That didn't turn out to be the case, though the cast still makes for some unconventional orchestration. Simon Kaplan, playing Saad, plays the clarinet, while Natalie Sherwood, Marat, jams on cowbell. Elena Montero Mulligan, Polpok, plays piano, and music director Mark Verdel, Rossignol, plays guitar. Jessica Fleming, Kokol and Lavoisier, covers the trumpet, though it must be said that she and drummer Emily Levenstone, Kukuruku, both play ukulele. Jermona Sharp has Riggs' favorite instrument in the ensemble, a Bible, that her character, Wu, inexorably thumps as a percussion instrument. Other cast members fill in on miscellaneous objects, from an empty instrument case to a bag of Bananagrams tiles, whatever Riggs had at hand. The hodgepodge instrumentation suits the music. What landed in my lap was a series of songs that sound like they come from completely different shows, Britt says. The varieties of styles, timbres, tempos, and influences, each song is a score unto itself. Gentle or loud, each note pushes matters toward the breaking point as people imprisoned for years are finally given a chance to say and act on exactly what they're thinking. When you open the door, when you open that door, Britt says, what do the floodwaters do? A dangerous question gets a musical answer in Durham this week. Okay, it's time for some food and drink. There's quite a few articles here. We'll see what we can get to. One hell of a sandwich is this one by Nick Williams, a food writer for Indie Week. Wegmans. I first heard of Wegmans while watching the episode of The Jinx, where Robert Durst gets arrested for shoplifting a sandwich from the grocery chain. The uber-wealthy alleged murderer, whose trial coincidentally began last week, was on a nationwide bail-jumping odyssey, had $500 in his pocket, and still felt the need to swipe a chicken salad on rye. Must be one hell of a sandwich, I thought. Last September, Wegmans opened its first location in Raleigh's Midtown to a line 3,000 people deep. Another one in Cary is scheduled to open in August. Such super fandom, of course, was met with side-eye on the Internet, but no matter. The heart wants what it wants, and the people wanted Wegmans. 6 months later, they haven't stopped wanting Wegmans. And I wanted to see if Wegmans could possibly live up to this much hype. First thing to know, the Raleigh Wegmans is massive. It's not exactly aesthetically pleasing. It looms over a double-stack parking deck like a suburban Kremlin. The interior is no better, a low-lit massing of browns, brownish greens, and bad fonts, like a desaturated 1980s mall food court. But you're not here for the graphic design. You're not even here for the vast grocery selection. Okay, maybe you are. Or the legitimately excellent cheese and charcuterie options. You've come for the staggering array of meal options and prepared foods. a sub shop, a pizza parlor, burger joint, a bakery, a sushi counter, a labyrinthine heart bar, and a phalanx of neatly packaged, ready-to-eat meals, all housed in a cavernous antechamber in the store's northern wing. This is what makes Wegmans famous, and what turns millionaire alleged murderers into common thieves. I wanted to find out whether this stuff was any good. So, one day, my wife, Kate, and I crept through the sea of nigh unmanageable traffic surrounding the store to try to assemble a meal from its intimidating assortment of fresh comestibles. Loyalists speak in hushed tones of Wegmans sushi, promising quality and selection to rival any fish restaurant. Perhaps my first pick, a spicy scallop volcano roll, was too ambitious because, while it looked enticing, it tasted revolting. Fishy scallops piled atop unidentifiable rolls, the two elements joined only by a slick of pink watery mayonnaise. The bivalves themselves had the texture of pencil erasers. It was awful. A tray of nigiri, on the other hand, was way better than grocery store sushi has any right to be. Deft slices of salmon, tuna, and yellowtail laid with care on expertly cooked rice. The fish was fresher than what you'd find at 90% of the Triangle sushi bars, and it only cost $10 for 8 stout pieces. Onward to pizza, fired in a hulking glazed brick behemoth and laid out in the style of an NYC slice shop. The margarita was okay. They cooked the basil with the pie, which is a great way to ruin basil. Slightly better was the cheese slice, beautifully greasy and nostalgically satisfying. A high-end version of the pizza served at the roller rink birthday parties of my childhood. Kate perused the hot bar's seemingly infinite options before ladling up a tray with a weird global fusion tableau. The pot stickers were unmemorable. We both enjoyed the delightfully trashy stir-fry of slippery udon and tough yet peppery beef, although the paneer curry was worryingly cold. I also hit the sub shop, which, to the employees at the checkout station, cemented my status as a glutton. "Oh, you got a sandwich, too?" a cashier asked as he rang up our hail. It must be Hall. He looked concerned.
"He needn't have worried. I'm a professional."
A professional who now loves Wegmans sandwiches. If anything could turn me into a Wegmans regular, it's Danny's Favorite, a sandwich named after, I don't know, the kid from The Shining, maybe. It's a piece of work, this sandwich, with spicy ham, capicola, salami, and provolone on a sub roll that glistens with its own barely contained supply of lipids. I got mine with banana peppers and brown mustard. It absolutely made my day. It made my next day, too, when I hauled the uneaten half out of the fridge and devoured it cold. Unctuous and processed and jammed with nitrates, this is not a good sandwich, but it is a great one. A completist essay of Wegmans is impossible outside of a multi-volume tome, but I couldn't make a game attempt without sampling a few more items, which took the form of some attractively jewel-boxed, ready-to-eat meals brought home to the farm. To the fam. The spicy General Cho's chicken was depressing, though I found its guileless idea of what spicy means to be sort of funny. I also picked up a tray of meatballs and another of ravioli, and it was here, in these Italian-like specialties, that I located the heart of Wegmans' appeal. They tasted fake, but that doesn't mean bad. More like an aristocrat's attempt to recreate the oeuvre of Chef Boyardee, drenched in sugar and sodium, but innately pleasing in a lizard brain sort of way. The meatballs, dense and humming with dried herbs, proved a big hit with our 2-year-old, who solemnly declared them very good. This from a kid who once described meatballs I spent an entire afternoon fussing over as yucky. Oh, and the cannelloni are amazing. Definitely pick up a box to rage eat while trying to get out of the parking lot. That's Wegmans on Waketown Drive in Raleigh. Continuing food and drink, unfamiliar narratives. Sarah Edwards, contributing editor on this. Vivian Howard's new series explores the foodways of the American South with candor and nuance. Episode 2 of Somewhere South begins with a simple montage. An instant grits package is torn open, poured into a ubiquitous-looking yellow bowl, and slid into the microwave. Voila! Porridge 101. But like most of the food examined on Vivian Howard's new PBS show, the dish is not as straightforward as it seems. Where A Chef's Life, the documentary series that Howard hosted for 5 seasons, zeroed in on specific ingredients, Somewhere South fixes a wider lens on southern foodways. Over 6 episodes, Howard explores foods that cut across cultures and experiences. The show, produced by the Durham-based Marque Media, premieres this week at the Carolina Theater. Triangle viewers will recognize a number of familiar faces, including chefs Chiti Kumar, Ricky Moore, and Michael Lee. The porridge episode is particularly characteristic of the show's commitment to candor. Instant grits turn into a conversation about slavery and racial injustice when Howard travels to Charleston to celebrate the late chef Edna Lewis and sits down with African-American food writers and chefs to discuss the history of soul food. It's not a manicured discussion, and at times the pauses are viscerally uncomfortable. Howard doesn't rush to fill the silence. Sure, she identifies as a storyteller, but she's there to listen. But this is what makes Somewhere South so valuable. Nuance has a place at the table. Simple dishes co-mingle with complex ones and familiar narratives with ones that are less celebrated or that have been erased from discourse about the American South altogether. Beyond the show, which will air Fridays on PBS between March 27th and May 1, Howard has other projects on the burner. In February, she announced that she'll expand from North Carolina to Charleston, where she'll open a new restaurant, Lenore, and establish a brick and mortar for her mail order baking business, Handy Plus Hot. Ahead of the Somewhere South premiere, the Indie spoke with Howard about the foods that, as she puts it, soften the edges about the way we feel around about our neighbors. This is a question answer. A Chef's Life was airing during the 2016 election, and you talked about bridging the urban-rural divide. How has this filmmaking process been different? Do you feel the media narrative around these places has changed? I think it would be hard to argue the media perspective has stayed the same, but really, our goal is to make content that softens the edges around the way we feel about our neighbors. I had that mission in 2016, and I have the same one now. We certainly are mindful of this because the whole goal of the show was to broaden the definition of Southern food. A Chef's Life told a narrow version of that story, and in an effort to be more inclusive and transparent and curious, we wanted to dig deeper and learn more and share that. On that note, what has this show allowed you to explore you weren't able to explore in A Chef's Life? Well, A Chef's Life was really very much about my personal life and professional life and my restaurants. The premise behind this is that every episode is about a dish that every culture shares, and it's about looking at all types of communities in the South and showing us how the South is really just a microcosm of the rest of the nation. What surprised you the most while filming? There's so much I learned about actual human history through food, seeing the common threads between the way we eat. We filmed in Clarkston, Georgia for this episode on greens. Every culture has their way of cooking greens, and we learned a lot from several refugee communities there. Clarkston is one of the most diverse square miles in the whole nation. We ate at a woman's house from Burundi, and she cooked this feast for us. And while the ingredients were very different, we had fufu and okazi leaves and meat that was braised in red palm oil. I'd never seen any of these ingredients, but it was very much the way that the southern table looks like. When my family sat down to eat, there was a pot of beans. There was a piece of bread you ate with your hands that we used to sop up the grease from these beans. There was a messy-looking piece of braised meat. It was the same. It made me feel connected in a way that I hadn't realized that I was. Shifting gears, you have these new outposts in Charleston. What's your connection with the city? I lived in Charleston one summer during college and was a server at Sticky Fingers, like two blocks from where the restaurants will be. As a Southern chef, I've traveled to Charleston for far more festivals than I'd like to mention. I've always said that if we were to open more restaurants, that would be somewhere that I want to spend more time, and I find Charleston incredibly charming. All that being said, I opened a restaurant in Kinston 14 years ago in an economically depressed region. Kingston has evolved somewhat. It's a tourist destination, but it still has a lot of challenges. The opportunity to open a restaurant in a city that's growing, that has a thriving dining scene, and a city that I love, it's not an opportunity to pass up. And finally, can you tell me about the restaurant named Lenore? I live in Lenore County, and you know, names are so hard. Several people pressured me to name it Vivian's, and I was like, no, I will not do that. But Lenore, the word itself is pretty. It makes you question if it's French. I love having the idea of something really sophisticated sounding, tied to this rural agriculture, tobacco-focused county in eastern North Carolina. Well, coming up that elevator shaft are the strains of our musicians, leaving me just enough time to say that this Indie Week will be available as a podcast on our website following the initial broadcast. Reading for our blind and print-impaired listeners, I am your host, John Fetterson. Now, I have a whole studio to wipe down with disinfectant to discourage our virus. And I hope all of you out there are scrubbing hands vigorously. So, for our band today, Yolanda and Harold Buff Orpington, John Fetterson says, I'll be back in a week with the next issue of Indie Week. So long, folks. Keep yourselves healthy.